You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM.
Arnie Sherman, good Sunday morning.
Good morning, Scott. We got a great guest today. We've had him on before, Jim Harmon. He has a book out now, The Sneakiest Man That Ever Was. Great gems of local history, making Missoula history back 100 years or more, making it fun and interesting. And I've read the book. You've read the book. Terrific stories. And I'm looking forward to asking him about it, how he put this all together and you know, what was his thinking in terms of writing this book and getting these colorful people into print.
Yep. We'll be back with our guest, Jim Harmon, back after this. Arnie Sherman, we are back with our guest, Jim Harmon.
Jim, it's good to have you back on the show. How have you been?
I have been quite good, quite busy since our last meeting. Unexpected things have happened, including a book. I hadn't really intended that, but it's been a pretty exciting time.
In 2 years since you've been on the show, and that wasn't on the horizon 2 years ago. So what was the genesis of this book? By the way, for our listeners, I've read the book. It's headline stories of Montana's early days, and the main title is "The Sneakiest Man That Ever Was," which is the first story in the book.
Yeah. Well, the last 2 years have been very interesting. I've been writing the various columns on a weekly basis for the Missoula Courant, an online newspaper in Missoula, it's between 5 and 6 years now, and developed enough of a readership that folks kept hounding me. Why don't you write a book? Why don't you put some of these old gems into a book or some additional material? And I kind of let it pass. But in the last year, I got to chatting with Dale Burke at Stonydale Press in Stevensville. And we've had some delightful conversations over the last year and a half or so. And it finally came down to my wife and I deciding whether we really wanted to get into the book publishing thing. And we decided, why not? So I got together with Dale. We put together a deal to publish a book. And it took me a long time to figure out how to write a book. I write, but I know nothing about how you put a book together. It was one of the most complex things I've ever run into. Now that I've done it, I've got it. So another one in the future will be a piece of cake by comparison. But it all had to be done in order, all sorts of things that I don't normally do. I just say, here's a pile of manuscripts, kind of put it together. So we worked on this for better part of a year, and the saddest part of it was that Dale Burke, wonderful fellow, died of a heart attack the day after he and I had chatted in the afternoon about the final additions and corrections for this book.
Jim, and that could be the first story in your next book.
It could well be. I attended his funeral. Hundreds of people turned out. He was so well known in the Bitterroot and beyond, fishing, hunting, outdoors activities, environmental concerns, saving the land. Dale was just such a name and such a presence. That delayed things, of course, because his poor daughters didn't know too much about the book publishing business. Rachel, one of the daughters, was trying to learn to take over the business. In any event, she stepped in, and it took about a month, but we finally managed to make sure that the printer had all the final changes. Then the publishing took place, and the books were out around November 1st. Again, readers encouraging me to do so, I guess, is the first part of the question. I'm happy my wife and I decided to do it. The title of the book is a result, really, of some of the grandchildren sitting on the deck toward mid to late summer. And I had a list of the table of contents of this proposed book. So I handed it around to their parents and to the grandkids. And I asked, well, which one of the stories, you know, just from the name of it, grabs your attention? It was unanimous, the sneakiest man that ever was. And that's the story of one of the most the well-known characters in Missoula history, Coyote Bill, a man whose real name was Beescove, and Colonel Beescove, as he preferred to be called, because after all, he claimed to be a scout for Custer. No one really knew if that was true, but that's what he claimed.
And didn't he live as a recluse, sort of up the Rattlesnake?
He did. His place was up the Rattlesnake, a considerable distance out of Missoula. He had a piece of land there, but the trouble was he sort of claimed all the land in the vicinity, and the roads, the bridges, whatever existed back then in the late 1800s. By golly, Coyote Bill owned all that. So if you wanted to come up and cut firewood, go fishing, do hunting, whatever, you had to get by Coyote Bill on the road. He would place boulders in the road, all sorts of things to stop people from going up there. And that led to his near demise. A couple of woodcutters had been going up on the property time and time again, and he had confronted them, and they'd had words. But it finally came down one time he found them on his land. They had crossed some border that he'd put cuts or flashing on trees, or marking his property. And they said, he said, "You're on the wrong side. You're on my property," and got out his rifle. And and before you knew it, he'd shot one of the fellas who fell by the wagon and in which they were loading wood. And Coyote Bill, strange fellow that he was, he did nothing to assist the wounded fellow. He basically ordered the other woodsman to stand back, stand aside. He mounted his horse, rode into town, and told the sheriff he's just shot a guy. And so he was locked up by the time the sheriff and his posse, if you want to call it that, arrived at the scene. The poor fellow had died of loss of blood. He didn't have to die, but that's the way Bill left him. His first trial ended in a guilty verdict, and he was sentenced to hang. But somehow he managed to get a second trial, change of venue to the Helena area, and that one resulted in a much lesser charge, and I believe it was about 10 or 12 years in prison. After which he got out, and he went back to the same sort of thing. He decided to do some mining out in what is now Sanders County. It was all part of Missoula County at the time. But I stand corrected in my own brain there. By then, Sanders County was still part of Missoula, but Flathead and Ravalli had been separated by that time, 1893 or so. In any event, he did some mining out east of Plains and Thompson Falls. And he claimed a number of gold claims. But there was a woman out in the area who disputed all that and said, no, those are mine or our claims. It came down to a trial in Thompson Falls at which he was to appear and show proof in some way that he owned that land out there and the claims that he claimed. He didn't show up for the trial. His attorney tried a marvelous feat of soft shoe routine in front of the court, hoping he would come in on the next train, and he didn't show up. About two or three days later, the sheriff went out to try to find him. He was face down in a creek with his throat slashed and wrists slashed, as I recall. It was said to be a suicide. That's the way it was ruled, but you have to wonder.
Yes, you have to wonder. So for our listeners, this is the kind of insight that you'll get from the book. 46 of these stories across 184 pages. And what I really liked about it is, beside it being gems of local history, the story you just relayed happened in the 1890s. And your writing style for this, which I want to ask you about, makes it seem like you were there. You know, that you had witnessed this in real time, that this was happening contemporaneously to each and every one of these stories. And I found that very appealing, and it just made you want to read story after story to get your insights and embellishments. So I want to ask you a little bit about, how did you go about gathering the ancillary information to embellish and enhance these news stories? I assume you found these news stories in the old archives of the newspapers, but then you had to get more information than just you could get from the printed word. So how'd you go about that?
Well, the process I've been doing for a little over 10 years, ever since I retired actively from the broadcasting world, radio and TV. And yes, it all starts with a story. And it takes a lot of work because a lot of these stories are from papers from 1864 on. There are online archives through Chronicling America, the Missoulian, to its credit, company has put in the money to archive old Missoulians, but only back to 1890. So between 1870 and 1890, none of that is easily available in an electronic version. You have to do the work finding the old microfilm of the newspaper, copying it digitally, in some cases page by page, at a microfilm reader at a library or the Mansfield at the university or at the Historical Society in Helena. So a lot of work goes into this. So all I was doing initially was reading old newspapers, because I retired from a world of journalism, and I just wondered, what was it like for the scribblers of the time, as they called themselves back in the 1800s? What were their styles? How did they approach a story? It varied widely, but I was enamored by the work they did, the style of their writing, all those things. After you spend a year or two reading these papers, anytime I came across something I thought was interesting, I'd clip it and save it digitally. And after a while, I had thousands of these clippings. At that point, it was, well, what do I do with them other than that was fun? And so I started more research into some of these. Some of these stories require a lot of footwork. In the case of Coyote Bill, I had so much information through newspaper articles on Mr. Bees Cove, right from back then right up to the present. I mean, Bees Cove Creek up the Rattlesnake still exists. They named the fire after Bees Cove in the last year or two, a summertime fire up there. But I didn't know what he looked like. I had no idea exactly what was his cabin like, where was it located. So I spent a lot of time on this story and others at the Missoula County Records Center. And
by the way, there are great photographs and great photographic representations in the book, right. You know, of what Missoula looked like and what some of these advertisements, for example, when Al Jolson came to town, know, it just adds a lot of you know, meat and pithiness to, you know, to reading this. This is just, this is not just newspaper clipping after newspaper clipping. This is a, these are interesting stories that paint a very, I think, broad picture of what Missoula, Montana was like before we were part, before Montana was a state.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I ran across. Finally, I found the trial documents for the murder trial of Coyote Bill at the Missoula County Records Center. And guess what was on top of the pile? An actual newspaper, yellowed with age, marked Exhibit A. And that is on the cover of the book, a portion of it. It's the, excuse me, the Anaconda Standard from, what is it here, June 23rd or 4th, 1905. That was the trial date. But there was a photo of Coyote Bill with a companion. Now, I'd had this vision of a crusty old guy. You know, think of any old, you know, movie you've seen about a hermit. I didn't envision a rather robust, somewhat slim, youthful-looking fellow. If I were to meet that person on the street, I wouldn't think hermit or, you know, any of these things. So I was surprised just by the photo. Then they had pictures of his cabin and the rattlesnake, all this in the newspaper. And so suddenly I felt a real connection with this fellow. But to get back to your original question, it's a job like that, going to the record center, digging through old files, trying to find other aspects of a person's life. In many cases, I have to go to genealogical websites in order to trace families and find out where from where they came, their children, etc., so I can kind of have an idea of how the family worked into the area in Montana.
So you're like a journalistic detective in the preparation of this book, just finding snippets that fit and put the puzzle together for each of the stories.
Yeah, it's definitely detective work, and I think I wrote in one of my more recent articles that it's more fun doing the research than writing the story. I mean, it really is. It just, you're taken down one direction, then you find something new. It takes you in a totally different direction. In fact, I'm working on one right now that may take better part of a year to even get a handle on it, because it is so complex and involved and yet so interesting on one of the wonderful, well, I don't want to say wonderful, one of the well-known old lawmen of the West here in the Missoula area, who is turning out not to be such a wonderful fellow.
Not such a good law. Not a good law. Let's do a quick ID. Our guest is Jim Harmon. His book is The Sneakinest Man That Ever Was, Headline Stories of Montana's Early Days, and that can be found at Stonydale Press Publishing and their website. Arnie.
So, Jim, a lot of the stories are fascinating and fit what many people would think were classic stories of the Old West. They're stories about famous people who have came through Missoula, like Mark Twain and Al Jolson and Ulysses S. Grant in 1883. You have stories about, you know, murder, mayhem, train robberies, brothels, and all that. But interspersed in all that, there are other fascinating tidbits that you found, two that particularly stood out to me. One was the story about the janitor and the Grizz football team. Would you share a little bit of that story with our listeners?
That one just tickled me. I couldn't believe it when I read it. I was going back. My intent wasn't to find that story. I was going back just to find out how did the Grizz, Montana Grizzlies actually begin in the earliest days. And it took me back to a time when they literally didn't have any uniforms, or they were hard to find, and were practicing in terrible cold winter-like weather outside on the campus.
They were wearing, in the case of the janitor that they brought in to be part of, you know, the practice squad, so to speak, he wore his overcoat over his, uniform.
Yeah, he was just walking by. It was not intentional. This poor fellow was just walking by. The team didn't have enough players to form an opponent, so they were recruiting anyone they could who walked by. So the poor janitor walks by, and they con him somehow into, being on the opposing team for a scrimmage. And within the first play or two, he's involved in a tackle, and he's at the bottom of the pile, and he feels the sharp pain near his groin, and it's like, oh my gosh, I don't know what has happened here. And by the time all the players and volunteers who had been walking by get off the dog pile there, he's bleeding severely down the leg.
I love and that story.
It turns out that he had simply had some sharp knives on him in a leather case from some work he'd been doing earlier. I can't recall exactly what it was, with the university president. And he was just walking by. He had them in his clothing, but because of the coldness, he left his jacket on, totally forgot about these knives. One of them pierced him quite badly. The members of the team and others had to rush him to a nearby doctor's office where he was patched up. But that's the kind of story I'm interested in.
Right.
Not necessarily the names and the dates and the places and the first Grizz game. All those things are interesting. I don't deny that. But this one just tickled me.
Right.
It's like, how could I not write about the janitor who just walked by?
Right. And for our listeners, his name was C.C. or Chick White.
There you go. Thank you.
The janitor at University of Montana, what, 1897?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, what you do beautifully, Jim, in your book is you describe the setting, the place, and the time beautifully. So as a reader, you're really kind of throwing yourself into a Missoula that you obviously don't recognize, but you can picture it. And I also found it very interesting when you talked about that football game and the scrimmage, how they kind of pieced together a practice team and who joined that practice team. Like officials from the, it's just... You just wouldn't see that.
And then you followed up with the first Grizz Cats game story where we lost because somebody talked on the sidelines.
I mentioned in the article in the book. I mean, I called everyone, Bill Schwanke, everyone else, Mick Holine. I called them all saying, I'm not making sense of this. What possibly could that mean that they were penalized for talking on a sideline? But apparently, I think it was Bill Schwanke who came up with the answer that it might have in some way been boisterous or maybe the words used weren't.
Might have been insulting to the referee.
Insulting to the referee. It might have been something like that. But none of the press reports back then or the UM archives, they're such wonderful archives back to that day that you can look at the university, and many of them are online now. But nothing really to explain that. But that penalty cost them the game.
The first Grizz Cat game. The other thing that really stood out to me, as a kid growing up back east, I remember vividly going to Woolworth's and to Kresge's, these little five and dime mini department stores. But you wrote a whole story about the Beehive stores.
Yeah.
And
they were, yeah.
That was fascinating to me. Will you share a little bit about that?
Sure. They were the thing, I guess, the Walmart of the day, although they were they were corporate in a way, and yet they were locally managed or owned. But they were everywhere. I believe they started in the Chicago area, but they could be found, and I think I detailed in the story, the many small communities in Montana that had a beehive story. Missoula's was particularly interesting only because it was in a building that was well photographed, and there was a high quality digital enhanced photo of this beehive story at Main and Higgins that became part of the book. And I just can't say enough about the wonderful help from the university archives at the Mansfield Library. Wonderful people to work with, and they have a way of getting me the materials now digitally rather than physically going there because of the current pandemic situation. But this building was about to fall down. It was a hazard to health in the community, and the fire marshal wanted it at least stabilized, fixed, or torn down. And what was his name? Schlotsky, I think, was the fellow who ran it at the time. And he was not terribly cooperative. He ended up selling the place rather than fix it. But these were stores that you see the ads on TV that, you know, for one time only, this record-breaking price. You have never seen such an incredible savings. Everything was labeled that way at a beehive story.
And they had 5-cent, 10-cent, 15-cent bins. What really jumped out to me was, this is the 1880s, and you had mentioned in the story there was one of these beehive stores in Fort Benton, and they were advertising – in the 1880s, Malaga grapes and pears and oysters that you could get. Oysters. Which was, to me, astounding back in the 1880s.
Oysters were the thing. Any newspaper you picked up back in the 1800s, I swear to God, was filled with little want ads. Fresh oysters just arrived at fill-in-the-blank store or saloon, wherever. Largely that, as a result of the Northern Pacific Railroad.
Right. Well, in the case
that,
of Fort Benton,
difficult.
I was going to say, in the case of Fort Benton, it was the last place for the steamships from Kansas City to bring goods up to the, you know, at the time Northwest Territory. So they maybe they had the sort of the pick of the litter, if you will, of goods that were arriving into this region and. Because you probably can't find any oysters now in Fort Benton, let alone in 1880.
I would suspect it's harder now, probably. But that was one of the things that just caught my eye. Just about every community, Missoula was crazy about oysters. Every saloon in town was advertising some oyster dish or raw oysters or whatever, along with whatever other fare they might have at their wonderful saloon.
Jim, you know, it is interesting is Missoula was also, there was a lot of like funny business going on in Missoula in this time. Were there any stories you edited and you didn't include because of the subject matter or because of the potential controversy?
No. No, I haven't. Number one. Number one. I go on the legal premise that anything prior to 1922 is public domain, and folks living at that time are no longer living, and therefore I can't
slander them. They're fair game.
Pardon?
They're fair game.
In essence, yeah. But, yeah, I wanted to be careful about that. Of course, anything later than that, and that's a deep, deep controversy there with what the public domain timeline is because of the Disney lawsuit, et cetera, over their cartoons, et cetera. But putting that aside, no, there weren't any particular stories that I wouldn't delve into. I tried to avoid anything that just seemed hurtful or outrageous. We're not familiar with that sort of thing today, of course. But I tried to avoid that from the past. It's just not in my nature. If it made sense in the context of the story, fine. But I wasn't just going to do a story because of its outrageousness, except for that kangaroo. I had to do that one.
The kangaroo story. And also you talked about Dunn Creek Nell, which ended you know, talking about being the red light district in Missoula and how, you know, how wild it was. The one thing that was fascinating, and you put it in very clear context, was as the railroad arrived in Missoula, Missoula went from 2,500 people to 12,500 people in like a year and a half, 2 years.
Yep.
That would be like going now from 800,000 to 400,000 people in 2 years. Could you imagine that, Scott? I mean, it would be impossible to deal with that kind of growth. But that's exactly what happened as a result of the railroad coming to town.
And at the time, versus imagining it today, what the reaction would be. At the time, it was a blessing. It was hard to find anyone who didn't want the railroad to come to Missoula. That was the link for commerce and transportation. Up until then, imagine the stagecoach, the mule teams and wagons of supplies.
You know, one of the things that it pointed out to me in reading, particularly that story, how important the railroad barons were. They were kingmakers. They could, if they put a rail spur in Missoula, Missoula became something. If they made a decision for whatever reason, either arbitrarily or politically or because of financial, you know, enticements, to not put the rail spur into Missoula, but do it, you know, into Hamilton, for example, or do it somewhere else, it would have changed the whole nature of the state. They really had boundless power just by deciding where the railroad was going to go and where it was going to stop.
Yeah, it certainly did. It was reflected in a couple of ways. The one story that involved the Golden Spike reenactment sort of thing, you know. That was supposed to be a private affair for only the president of the Northern Pacific Railroad and his invited guests all the way from Europe and across the country. But something in the number of thousands, I think 3,000 or 4,000 to 5,000 area people showed up. It was a big deal to them and also to Ulysses Grant, who was really the only celebrity there to acknowledge the huge crowd. The railroad was just the president on down were miffed that all these lowly people had shown up to their prestigious event. Yeah. But that gives you some indication of how important it was. The other one was putting in the Bitterroot line from Missoula to Hamilton. And the very fact that the Stephensville newspaper put out a special issue just on that and worked all night long to accomplish it, their reporter writing down to Hamilton, and then they scurried back to put the paper together so that when it stopped coming back to on the way back to Missoula, they could have this wonderful headline story hot off the press to hand to all those on the excursion tour, the first trip on the Bitterroot line. So, yeah, a big deal.
It was a big deal. I remember reading stories, and I can't remember exactly what city or town, but people who had anticipated the railroad was coming, and the town grew to 40,000 or 50,000 people, and then the railway changed its mind, and the town became virtually a ghost town.
Oh, the power was incredible. But on the flip side of that was the 1893 depression, I guess it would be called today, and that the railroads had overexpanded, really put too much money into it, had to pull back because of economic times, and that, of course, resulted in layoffs and terrible relations with their workers. And that, of course, led to the Coxey's Army and the unemployed railroad engineers hijacking trains from Spokane through Thompson Falls, Heron, all that, and then driving them at the breakneck speed toward Missoula, all to get to Washington to demand jobs.
Hey, Jim, so for our audience, you know so much about this area. Just for our audience who didn't know about you, furnish us with some details. You were a reporter with KPAX for a very long time, or was it KECI?
KECI. I ended up hiring so many people that ended up at both stations over time.
Right.
I hired Jill Valley and Aaron Yost and others who are a prominent in appearance at KPAX, hired a lot of people. Steve Fettfight hired me, then he left for a job in Oregon and he came back, and I hired him, and he rode the anchor desk for KECI for years until retirement just about a year ago. Mark Haka hired him, and he replaced me as the real meteorologist.
The real meteorologist.
replacing the happy weather guy, which I was. No, I had an avid interest in weather, and I studied it just like a journalist would, a weather story. So I am proud that all the forecasts were as accurate as they could be. But when it came time for that transition from the happy weather guy to the meteorologist, I didn't have the interest in pursuing a degree in that area. But yeah, I spent 20 years in radio and then about 30 in television and finally retired August 13th, which was a Friday the 13th, I believe, in 2010. So 10 years or so. A lot of different places from, I grew up in Libby, so as a high schooler at 14 to 18 years of age, I was a disc jockey, an announcer, and read the local obituaries on the air on good old KLCB radio.
What is your assessment of news today, certainly local news, and how has it changed, if at all?
Oh, it's changed dramatically on all levels. I'm disappointed in local journalism only because of ownership. There was a time that most stations were owned locally. You had a direct line to the owner of the station. If you didn't like something, you could go talk to Mr. Jones. Well, they're by and large corporately owned now, unfortunately, and the dictates come from somewhere back east. And in many ways, the corporations tend to want to influence down to the local level what a newsroom might be producing on a given day. That is outrageous and offensive to me. I can't imagine that. And I'm glad I'm not part of that anymore. But I must say, and of course the whole thing that's happened with newspapers is so sad. I may have been in broadcast journalism my life, but I'm a newspaper reader, and I have great respect for what the newspaper industry has done over many, many decades, a century or two or three. Just marvelous work, but it's all changed. newspapers are dying by the hundreds. Staffs are diminished in newspapers to the level of local radio stations that in many cases have one person or a halftime person devoted to actually news gathering. And that's just, my goodness, that just seems so wrong. I of course, am encouraged by the digital age and things like Missoula Current, where a former press a news journalist decided to make an online newspaper. I am absolutely, gobsmacked by the fact that anyone could do that. One person with a few helpers putting out a daily newspaper with relatively constantly updated stories, just absolutely amazing. But I'm not happy with the current state of journalism, unfortunately. There are exceptions. And the people, now I must say, the young people involved in the news business today, whether it's print or broadcast, I think they still have the same ethical standards and the same desires to do good work, but I'm not sure the support is there by those who own those entities.
You know, I remember when I first came to Montana, there were three or four investigative journalists statewide who really dug into stories. Now, I don't think there's one left that really has the portfolio to go out there and dig in and you know, really tell a story anymore. It's all headlines.
Yeah. And it's,
I think a lot of that's dictated from their corporate. I mean, if we're certainly talking about television, from their corporate parents. We at radio, we have a lot more flexibility with local news. There's not really much of a dictate on what we should or shouldn't report. In fact, they want us to be more local. They want us to be more community. They want us to be of the community more, much like the current. But there just aren't many of us. That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Like I say, I still believe strongly in those individuals who, I shake my head, why are you even choosing this vocation, this profession in life?
It's probably one of the reasons that people of a certain age are so loyal to 60 Minutes, because you get a full, in-depth story every week. And I've been watching it, as long as it's been on the air, and I look forward to hearing the texture to a story and their ability to reach in and give you more detail than you can get anywhere else.
And also, to their credit, is the fact that when they make a mistake, they own it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were right there to tell you, we made a mistake and here's how it happened. There's no hiding behind anything. And that's it's just too bad in today's – well, I have to back up. Everyone talks about the media instead of journalism or news. And, they talk about Fox News. But what they're really talking about is a Fox News personality just talking about things, not – the news. So it's messed up.
Yeah, well, that line has really gotten blurry between editorial comment and news. That's why this whole thing about, factual or fake has come in, because it's the blur between reporting the actual occurrence or the situation or the circumstance and then somebody giving their opinion about it, and that being used as news.
My wife and I sit watching various news programs in the evening on TV, or listening on radio, as the case may be. And quite often, we just shake our heads and say, "What's the context of this? Or was that an opinion that?"
I remember
you shouldn't be doing those things if you're watching the news.
I remember historically the fact that Edward R. Murrow made personal comments about Joe McCarthy and stepped away from just reporting news was a story in and of itself that someone as respected as that finally couldn't take anymore and said what he thought. Up until that point, you know, newsmen just reported fact or the information or you know, the release, and that was it. They didn't offer any kind of comment about it.
But I would say in Murrow's case, he'd had enough of what was not true, and someone had to step up. And to that extent, I applaud him from stepping away. The only darts I could throw at Murrow were the fact that he was conned into doing so many celebrity interviews live on TV that he did not want to do, but he acquiesced in order to continue doing what he loved doing.
Do you think that? Do you think that the most recent kind of, you know, the conspiracy theories and all the work that the current administration has done to try to discredit our, you know, elections and voting, that the press has really fallen down on the job by not keeping them accountable? Like you know, I know that CNN has a particular angle. And then Fox has a particular angle, but this whole blurring of the lines has not said, here is, you know, here's what it means to be accountable to the media. You know, the media's been beaten so much.
Well, everything has changed. This blurring has occurred with the diversity of the internet and social media. I sort of alluded to the fact in a recent article about the fact that I view everything as contemporary, dating back to the 40s and 50s, and don't view it as history until it's older than that. But I'm reminded at the same time that there are youngsters and young adults who don't know much about the past. They don't have a perspective. They don't know about Edward R. Murrow and Joe McCarthy. They should. It was a very pivotal moment in American history that can teach you a lot about ethics and responsibility and challenging power and saying that's not right based on the facts. Because of the blurriness of today's media world, the news, as just the straight, just the facts, has somehow been lost. Too many of the networks have talk shows. They talk about the news all the time. They voice their opinions, and that's blurred next to the following program that might be straight news, but how do you discern one from another anymore? Then you add in on top of that highly elected officials saying that's fake, don't believe it. The press is the enemy of the people. Again, I love that word. I'm gobsmacked. I can't really grasp it. And how do we get out of this hole? How do we get back to believing trust in journalism again? The facts matter, but the facts are now called into question on a regular basis, and suppositions, theories, various thoughts are projected through the media as being the truth without any evidence backing it up.
How can you do that? Let's do a quick break. I want to do a quick break. Our guest is Jim Harmon. The name of his book is The Sneakiest Man That Ever Was, Headline Stories of Montana's Early Days, published by Stonydale Press. Back after this.
Are you being audited?
Back with our guest, Jim Harmon.
Jim, where can our listeners get your book?
Well, the first location would be harmonshistories.com. harmonshistories.com. The book is there. You can order it directly from me, and I would appreciate that. That having been said, I support local business entirely. It is available at wonderful bookshops in Missoula, Hometana Store, Fact and Fiction, Shakespeare and Company, The Book Exchange, and the Bitterroot at Valley Drug, etc. It's available widely, so you should have no trouble finding it. Right.
Jim, let's not make it 2 years before you come back on again. We got a lot more to talk about, don't we, Scott?
We absolutely do. You've been a great guest, Jim. We appreciate it very much.
I couldn't be more delighted to be here. As you know, I love talking about this old stuff.
We appreciate
well it. Worth the read.
Exactly. Arnie, I'll see you next week.
Yes, Scott. Take care.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.
Lover.